I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Star Wars, the sixth and final film in the epic series, arrived in theaters this week, and depending on who you listen to, it is either the best thing for theater since corn popped, or it will be remembered for Mr. Potato Head with a Darth Vader mask. However, few would argue about the cultural power of Star Wars.
Use the Force, Luke. Let go, Luke.
The Force is strong in this one.
Luke, trust me.
Luke, you switched off your targeting computer. What's wrong?
Nothing. I'm all right. I lost R2.
28 years ago, when the first Star Wars film was released, that's right, 28 years ago, one reviewer wrote that the story of the film could be written on the head of a pin and still leave room for the Bible. See, that was never the point. Star Wars has always been about the mix of special effects and the fight for good and evil.
You have learned much, young one.
You'll find I'm full of surprises.
So now we have this span of nearly three decades to measure the Force of George Lucas. Well, what is your perspective? Have his Star Wars films been good or bad for Hollywood? Do these movies offer a welcome return to the world of myth and magic? Or do they rely too much on technical tricks? And where do you see the pop culture legacy of Star Wars? When Ronald Reagan addressed the Soviet Union as the evil empire, everyone knew where he got those words. So how have the films really changed us? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Dade Hayes joins us from a studio in New York. He's senior editor of Entertainment Weekly and a co-author of Open Wide, How Hollywood Box Office Became a National Obsession. Dade, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
And Ty Burr is here in the Connection studio with me. He is film critic for the Boston Globe. Ty, it's nice to have you here as well.
Thank you very much.
Now, I think that you wrote that this might be, in fact, the best of all Star Wars films?
Oh, you know, it's open to endless Talmudic argument over, you know, there are people who believe that the first one is the one that changed everything for them. There are many people who believe The Empire Strikes Back is the best of the entire series. I went into this a total doubter. I'm certainly not a huge fan of the most recent two films.
Nobody is, though, are they?
And all the other critics who went into the screening went in with low hopes, and we were quite surprised at how emotionally powerful was it. And in a way, I think this is the one that actually makes good on all the mythic resonances that Lucas and his followers have always claimed for him.
What do you think, Dade?
Well, I did enjoy it to some degree. I wouldn't say it's far and away the best of the six. I mean, I actually, ended up feeling a little bit deflated just by the, I'm in this group that says that the latter three are kind of in their own category, that are always doomed to be less than I think our fantasies of greatness can allow.
Is that because are less enchanted by what it is Lucas can do technically, or is that because the story wears thin, Dade? What's your conclusion?
I think we're too dazzled by the technical wizardry. I mean, I think it's something, this film has something on the order of 2,100 effect shots, which is, more than 15 times the original, and it just seems like it's become this kind of canvas for those kinds of techniques. I mean, in your intro, you shrewdly noted that it's really never been about complex storytelling. It is kind of this, old myth, kind of pastiche of mythologies. But nevertheless, I think now it's just become really like a showcase for the technique rather than anything close to the heart and the kind of the spirit of the original.
Hey, Dade, can I ask you something? How old were you when the first ones came out?
I was 5 years old, and I saw that original movie, I think 4 or 5 times in the theater, and then many more times over the subsequent
years. Why is the question irrelevant one in your mind, Ty?
Because I saw it at a completely different age and place, and because of that, the first three do not have that stature in my mind. I think that they're important films, certainly to the history of Hollywood. I saw them at precisely the wrong time. I was 20. I was in college. I was a cinema studies student. I was watching the films of Fassbender. I was exactly in the wrong place.
So did
to
you
see
turn
Star
your
Wars.
Nose up at the originals?
I and my little snotty film school friends turned up our noses at Lucas, and we thought this was just a heresy. This was exactly where American film should not be going. We were very elitist about it. And of course, I saw it in the theater. I saw the sequels in the theater, and I remember being quite snippy about them mm-hmm. as well. And it was not until I watched, really, truly, was not until I watched it, the first three films about 5 years ago with my daughters and saw them through a kid's eyes that I really realized what it was all about. And literally at one point, my younger daughter turned to me and said, "This is the best movie I've ever seen." You know, and how can you say no to that? And through her eyes, it was. But I did approach this last film. I approached the whole new trilogy without the sacred meaning of the first three films. And I think that marks me off as probably in the minority.
I actually remember Time magazine, and this was before there was so much so many tie-ins where, you know, Time Life would probably own a piece of this firm that would be selling the film. But Time magazine did a huge cover piece, a huge takeout on the very first one. And we all sort of went, why? What's such a big deal about this? But then it had that that kind of impact with everybody wondering, whoa, how has it changed Hollywood? I don't know. Dade, when you look back over the 30-odd years since that one came out, when we talk about blockbusters and it bringing in or sort of ushering in a new era of blockbusters, is it fair to hang that around the neck of the first Star Wars?
Well, I think plenty of people have, and I think they're partly justified in doing so. I mean, I think one of the more famous cases was made by Peter Biskind in his book about the 70s. You know, he mounts a fairly persuasive case and certainly talks to enough filmmakers and creative people from Hollywood in this, you know, from the 70s who feel like, you know, this kind of door was slammed shut effectively around the time of Star Wars. But I think it did begin a lot sooner. In our book, Open Wide, my co-author and I explore, you know, movies like Billy Jack and certainly things like The Towering Inferno or The Poseidon Adventure. I mean, these were, you know, films that really found a very, very wide audience even before Jaws in 1975. So it kind of was a case of the momentum starting to shift kind of early in the decade. And then by the time it reached Star Wars, it really was about the merchandise and about the kind of universe that Lucas was creating. That was the real legacy of that first film. Because don't forget, it was released on only 39 screens. So it wasn't the kind of super saturation that we're seeing, the lines around the block at midnight in 2,900 theaters the way we did last night or Wednesday night. Yeah. So it's a different world that we live in. I think Lucas is partly, to blame or to be given credit for this new era, but it's not all his doing.
Ty, when we talk about blockbusters here, how do we define blockbusters? I'm trying to figure out, you know, what effect Star Wars may have had on Hollywood. I don't know what to put in the box of blockbusters and what to leave out.
Well, Hollywood sort of learned to do it backwards because they saw Jaws and they saw Star Wars, both of which were movies that nobody expected to work, both of which were disasters in the making. You know, you read about Jaws as it was being made. Spielberg thought his career was over. Everybody was telling Lucas this was the silliest idea, especially after American Graffiti, a little, you know, sci-fi thing. And as noted, you know, it was released on a fairly small amount of screens. But the natural pop culture tsunami behind both those movies created an event that Hollywood then learned to manipulate and manage and self-create, which is what they do, best now.
I was going back in the list of the Oscar winners to try and figure out into what world this film arrived. In 1976, the winner of the Best Picture was Rocky. And I thought to myself, okay, there's a film that nobody expected would do well. Sylvester gambled everything on this, and the people embrace it, and they made it a popular film. Does the same thing work in the Star Wars history as well?
Well, Star Wars were never an Academy Award.
They won all the technical awards in 77.
Exactly.
Not picture, not director, not, you know.
The culture in the first run of the Star Wars movies, the sort of pop culture media mavens always turned their noses up at the films. They were, you know, definitely a major force, a major marketing force. They remade how Hollywood made and released movies, but you couldn't really take them seriously as culture. What was interesting is to watch how everybody fell behind and in line when Episode One came out, and you know was expecting. You know, expecting the genius.
Episode
to be,
one was the second or the third.
The
one
first
released.
Of the second trilogy.
Okay, gotcha.
The Phantom Menace. I know it's hard. He did it backwards. But everybody was hoping for lightning to strike, and a lot of people sort of forced themselves to see lightning strike. And by the time of the second one, Attack of the Clones, it was harder to see that.
It's worth noting here that the films that we're talking about in the 70s, you know, really weren't the original model. I mean, they were kind of the validation of a system that really took root in the 50s in the dawn of television. Television created this kind of virtual campfire or this, you know, living, this giant universal living room that, movie marketers could inject their message. It's really interesting when you go back to, you know, films like Hercules or even before then, some of the Warner Brothers monster movies, you know, like Them or about the giant ants. Mm-hmm.
So did Star Wars rescue Hollywood in that sense? Had people begun to turn so much to television that Star Wars was what brought people back into theaters, Dave?
I believe so. I mean, it really was the final kind of hit, you know, in that string in the 70s. I mean, Jaws certainly kind of lit the fuse, and then by the time Star Wars came along, it just kind of exploded, and then that whole model of marketing, you know, really popped.
Connection listeners, how did Star Wars change Hollywood? Did it change Hollywood? How did it change you? Are you still using those pop culture references from the films made back in the 70s? Were you lined up to see Revenge of the Sith? Where does it fit? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Well, Star Wars is many things to many people, and a lot of people like it, and a lot of people don't. But no one can argue with the fact that if Star Wars did anything for us, it helped us redefine good and evil. Here's the good side.
For 800 years have I trained Jedi. My own counsel will I keep on who is to be trained. A Jedi must have the deepest commitment, the most serious mind. This one, a long time have I watched. All his life as he looked away to the future, to the horizon, never his mind on where he was, what he was doing. Adventure, excitement. A Jedi craves not these things. You are reckless.
Thank you, Yoda. Do I even need to talk about what signifies the dark side?
Your fleet is lost, and your friends on the Endor moon will not survive. There is no escape, my young apprentice. The Alliance will die. As will your friends. Good. I can feel your anger. I am defenseless. Take your weapon. Strike me down with all of your hatred, and your journey towards the dark side will be complete.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Ty Burr, film critic for the Boston Globe. Joining us from New York, Dade Hayes, senior editor of Entertainment Weekly. We'd like to know your thoughts on where Star Wars fits in this country's popular culture or even in your own growing up. We're going to start in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Alex is on the line. Hello, Alex.
Hi, good morning.
What do you think?
Well, I would say, you know, I was a kid when the first ones were coming out, and man, I can't tell you, I ate them up like candy. And I think that the new films have a sort of impossible problem to try to solve, and that's you know, the first ones were filled with corny dialogue and sort of, you know, the sort of like madcap space opera stuff. And then when we get to these, you know, these, you know, the later three films or the, you know, the prequel episodes 1, 2, and 3, they are, they're a lot, they're sort of forcing that same kind of thing, but people are more reluctant to accept the sort of corny dialogue.
Isn't that just you and me getting older, though, Alex? We have less patience for that kind of schlock.
You know, it didn't bother me, honestly. You know, the first film I didn't really like. Having seen, I went, you know, I'm a big enough nerd that I went and I saw the third film on opening night, and
did you like it?
I did, actually. I thought it was great. You know, it's filled with bad writing and some poor acting, but I think that it really does complete the story, and it does reveal that the first three movies are more about, in my opinion, what happens to the Republic, and not sort of what happens to any one character, because no real character undergoes any sort of development.
Well, you know, Ty Burr and I were talking about that just a couple of minutes ago, Alex, the idea that the dialogue just seems to get worse and worse. But you've got a slightly different take on this.
Well, I mean, Lucas has spoken of modeling his dialogue. I mean, and we all agree that, you know, any scene with Natalie Portman and especially the last two movies has been dreadful, and she's a wonderful actress. So why is that happening? But Lucas has said that he specifically wrote dialogue to mirror the dialogue of films from the 30s and 40s, and not just the B-movies that he grew up on and the, you know, the Flash Gordon serials, but the dialogue of classic Hollywood. The problem is, there's two problems. Today's actors don't know how to do that.
What, sound like Clark Gable?
To read those lines, those sort of iconic, non-nuanced lines that are sort of subtext without text. The other thing is that this go-around, there's less lightness, less humor. The first three films, you know, episodes 4, 5, and 6, have a real lightness to them that these ones don't. And I think one thing that nobody's really noted is how missed Harrison Ford or somebody like him is to these last three films. The famous example being when he's about to get frozen into carborundum or whatever it is, and Carrie Fisher says to him, "I love you," and he says, "I know." Harrison Ford wrote that line on the set. George Lucas did not write that line. In fact, George Lucas's line was, "I love you too." So he's been running that line for a long time. The closest these movies came is Jar Jar Binks, and I think everybody knows what we think about him.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And just a quick note also, there's not even a scene of that Laurel and Hardy kind of dialogue with R2
right.
and 3PO in this latest one. I definitely miss that.
But hold me like you did at Lake Nubu or whatever it is. Just like,
that's good stuff.
Now, if C-3PO said that to R2-D2, then we'd have an interesting movie.
Do you buy it, Dave, that it is, in fact, a throwback to an attempt to try and recapture the clutch cargo, two-dimensional, cutout-type people talking to each other?
I do buy that. I think it's definitely been in the kind of charter, you know, in the sort of DNA from the very, very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly he was sort of... I think that's actually... That helps explain the hold that this franchise has on the kind of pop culture consciousness. I just think it sort of summons up, you know, on the kind of mythological side, the sort of Joseph Campbell, you know, Kurosawa kind of ancient myth. And then in terms of just the straight dialogue and the kind of acting, the mannered acting style, it does sort of hark back to these earlier eras. And I think that's sort of, you know, it's sort of like these revivals of, you know, 50s. It's like, why did Sha Na Na hit in the 70s? Same reason, you know? I think there's a sort of a kinship there with other sort of phenomena that have come along by kind of calling back to earlier times.
All right, let's go a little further with this. Medford, Massachusetts. Dean's joining us on the line. Hi, Dean. What you think?
Well, thank you. Pleasure being with you. And
the force be with you. No, I didn't say that.
Yes,
go on.
The force. Well, I was 35 years old when I took a young male to the movies to see this thing, and I hadn't seen any big blockbusters. I hadn't seen Jaws, but I took him. We got the last two seats in the house. We're sitting in the first row, and Ty had said he was at just the wrong age. Well, now I'm an adult. I'm 35 years old, and it's the screen starts to scroll up, you know, in a long time ago in a faraway place, and all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of this battle, and within a few minutes, I've got sand and dust in my clothes. I mean, I'm squirming in my seat because it's so, you know, I was so much a part of it. So
is it a boy thing, Dean? I mean, this, I mean, the fascination with the battle and the spaceships, because I get caught up in it as well, and I'm wondering, oh, is this just like, you know, what do you think?
Well, I'm thinking if an adult wants to see this, sit in the front row. No, seriously.
Yep.
And B, I never watch movies in the front row, but now I sit a lot closer than I used to.
It's funny. I remember seeing Apocalypse Now from the front row in the Ziegfeld Theater in New York and literally having to turn 180 degrees when the helicopter goes across the screen at the beginning, and you really do get sucked into a movie that way.
I'm wondering, Dave, if the the technical side of it has reached a level of where it really can't go any farther. The stuff that he puts on the screen is so easy to believe if you're looking at as if you're looking at a civilization that is hundreds of years from now with all the spaceships in the sky and the kind of gritty little bus stops where these things come in and land. I mean, can they go any farther with this?
It's definitely made such a quantum leap over the first one where, you know, there were scenes where droids were being pulled by strings. And, you know, I mean, we can all kind of look back at that original and poke holes in it from a technical standpoint. But you're absolutely right. I mean, just the kind of, you know, the landscape that he creates is so persuasive. And even it's so busy. And I guess it's a subjective thing. Is that good or bad? I was staggered, as the caller was, just by that opening battle, by the sheer level of detail, the number of fighters, the number of, you know, little spiraling fireballs and things kind of shooting across the screen. If you contrast that with the original's opening, you know, scene with that, you know, Imperial cruiser kind of moving through very much like a Kubrick type of 2001 shot, very clean and austere, and you don't get as much of the kind of fine detail. But I don't know where it's all headed. It really is amazing. And certainly we've seen cases where, you know, the cart is definitely before the horse and they've thought of all these great effects, but, you know, there's really no story. I mean, at least you can say that this story is fulfilling, you know, the final part of a six-part endeavor.
And Connection listeners, if there is really not much story going on here, if it is all about technical effects, is that really such a bad thing? Is that dragging down the quality of what we see in other films from Hollywood? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Dedham, Mass. For our next call. And Taya's with us. Hi, Taya.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I grew up in Japan in the late 60s and the 70s, and the interesting thing about Star Wars is that there's a lot of similarity between the storytelling that Lucas came up with and old Japanese storytelling, specifically regarding good and evil, like was mentioned earlier, but also sort of the samurai master versus the novice, and also
He was a big fan of Kurosawa, wasn't he?
Right, well,
Lucas?
Actually, and he's admitted that the first Star Wars, a huge chunk of the plot comes from The Hidden Fortress, the whole Han Solo on the run with Princess Leia and the two, there's a warrior and a princess on the run in The Hidden Fortress with two comic slaves who become the robots in Star Wars.
Right, right.
So do you like it, Taya?
Oh, absolutely. I just think that from an original script standpoint, I don't think that there was much there. And in other words, earlier on, someone, I forget who was that, mentioned sort of redefining good and evil. And I'm not sure if it's so much redefining it, because it's just kind of rewriting it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of American movies are also influenced by
seem to have lost that line. Dade, can I just get you to pick up the good and evil part of this? We began the segment on it and didn't really talk about it. Was it a redefinition of that? Was it a throwback to a sort of simpler pre-World War definition of good and evil? What exactly is he playing with here?
I really think that, you know, from the very original film, it sort of anticipated this kind of, it was interesting you mentioned Ronald Reagan. It really did culturally kind of anticipate that sort of morning in America, you know, 1980s
Or did
clarity.
It help create it?
Mm-hmm. It did, arguably, definitely. I mean, I think that's what's so interesting, is that it just came along at this exact moment where, you know, people were just, you know, sick of the sort of ambiguity of the 70s and this, you know, you know, a period of real difficulty with, you know, financial crises and, you know, the oil shortage and all these kind of dark things going on. And it did sort of put forward this simpler notion. I think that's what people really grabbed onto.
And also remember that the films of the early 70s, before Jaws, before Star Wars, we were in a period of great nuance, great darkness, a lot of unhappy endings. Chinatown is the perfect example. It's a very, very complex...
Network was another example. Angry people on television.
A lot of people look back on that era with, you know, fondness as being a time of really good filmmaking and a time of really good complexity and wrestling with interesting questions. Star Wars blew that away. It completely replaced that with, don't worry about any of that stuff. There's just good and evil. That's all you got to worry about.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Leslie's with us. Hi, Leslie.
Hey.
So have you seen it?
Oh, which one?
The new one.
No. I haven't seen that yet, and I'll see it eventually. But I just love 4, 5, and 6, and I called up because y'all just had a point that you said, is it just a guy thing? And I really don't think it is, and I feel like such a dork just for saying it. I mean, I'm going to age myself real quick. I was born in 79, so I don't even know if I saw any of them in the theaters. But my dad used to have me and my younger brothers, that we'd pick like a rainy Saturday, and we'd have what we called a Star Wars festival, and we'd watch popcorn and just watch all three movies. And, you know, we all felt like lushes when we did it, but I was a kid. It's just one of my favorite memories from doing this. And I just, you know, when y'all were talking about the credits rolling across the screen at the beginning of it, and when y'all would play that music, you know, John Williams music, oh my gosh, I just got chills. And it's just one of my favorite childhood memories, so I don't think it's just a boy thing.
What can you put your finger, Leslie, on what it is that makes it stand apart from other things that you would have seen at that same age? I mean, clearly that memory you have of the rainy Saturday afternoon, I mean, I know what you're talking about, and those sorts of things, you know, really stick in your mind, but was it that, or was it the film? Was there something, I mean, did you play at this? Do you still use lines from the film, that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. One of my favorite lines is, you know, Luke, we've got company, from when they're rescuing Princess Leia, the first line. And my mom and I quote that to each other. And I used to, you know, go into her bedroom and take her little white slips and try and dress up like Princess Leia and play with the kids in the neighborhood. I collected Star Wars figurines. I mean, and it was, you know, it's not a complex movie. I think we've all established that. But it was a fun movie. And for a kid, I mean... And my dad ruined it for me when I was, like, in high school and said, now you realize there would be no explosions in space. The sound wouldn't sound like that. And I was,
way!
And I was like, Daddy, what are you doing? You just, like, ruined the whole thing for me. But, I mean, I want to go rent it right now. I don't own it. I want to go rent it and watch him with my boyfriend.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about this, Leslie, thanks a lot for your call. When we talk about the way that the language of these films lives on, I mean, Ty... We could come up with slogans from, you know, where's the beef and beer commercial slogans which enter popular culture. Is Star Wars in a class separate from that?
Well, I think every generation has its movie that's the campfire everybody gathers around. For people of my age, late 40s, it's The Wizard of Oz, which we grew up seeing, you know, every November on NBC or whatever channel it was on. And it's something that it's a glue. It's a generational glue. You can go up to somebody and say, and everybody knows exactly what that means and can fire it right back. Star Wars is the same thing. There aren't that many movies. The Beatles are another example, mm-hmm. a musical example. But every now and then you get this, you know, I called it in the review a transformative mass cultural experience, which is, you know, highfalutin, but it's kind of the only way to describe it, in that it's something that not only pulls everybody together, but moves the culture into a different place. And everybody pretty much across the board is into it. And those are very rare.
What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, there was a really revelatory moment for me in 1994 when I saw the film Clerks by a filmmaker, Kevin Smith, of my generation. Mm-hmm. This is before the original three Star Wars films were re-released theatrically. This is before Phantom Menace. So it was still in that period where we didn't know where this was all headed. And, you know, he has a large sequence in the film which takes place in a convenience store that kind of riffs on the construction of the Death Star. There's a Chewbacca song in the sound. soundtrack. So that was just terrific and a real discovery, and I really connected with that.
Yeah, you can see it coming back and back, and you can even hear it in the background. 1-800-423-8255. We're taking a short break. We're going to come back and hear more from you about the place of Star Wars, as a sort of cultural campfire for the country, but also how it changed Hollywood. We should talk a little bit about what we get in other films today and how much of that is the good side and how much of that is the dark side. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Listening to The Connection, I'm Dick Gordon.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father. Search your feelings. You know it to be true.
No! No!
1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation this hour. How do you follow that? Star Wars. Ty Burris, film critic for the Boston Globe. He's here with me in the studio. Dade Hayes is senior editor of Entertainment Weekly and author, co-author with Jonathan Bing of a book called Open Wide, How Hollywood Box Office Became a National Obsession. And Dade, just the one thing I wanted to pick up from what Ty was saying at the tail end of our last conversation was, you know, these things become cultural campfires, moments in people's childhood or adulthood, but how does it change when the span of production of these films goes to three decades? I mean, now you've got, you know, mothers taking kids to films that they were taken to as kids. Does that, is that just smart marketing, or is there more going on here?
Well, the apparatus and the machinery of producing these has become a lot more complicated. So even if, you know, people wanted to spit these things out one after the other, it would be a little tougher. I mean, something like Lord of the Rings, you know, which came out, you know, in three successive years, was shot all at once. So that was the way they kind of solved that. But,
right.
You know, I'm not sure if there's a grand design as far as, you know, that does sound like something from the dark side. You know, this kind of attempt to kind of, you know, hook people in when they're children and then, you know, seed the future consumer instincts in them at a young age. I'm not sure if that's really so much it, but it just is so much more complex and complicated. I remember kind of laughing out loud when, you know, Lucas originally said at the end of the first trilogy, when Return of the Jedi came out, he said he was aiming to revisit it sometime around 1993.
Hmm.
So that was 10 years hence, and I just remember thinking, I can't even think that far into the future. That's crazy. But he does have the long view. But I think he's sort of unusual that way, and it's because he's been able to be such an autonomous figure with his own company, his own kind of encampment in Northern California, far from Hollywood.
Right. I mean, let's not forget, by the way, when he traded away a larger directorial salary for the first Star Wars in exchange for the rights to the characters and the marketing rights.
Right, and sequel rights.
Sequel rights, yeah. Exactly. So he built that castle early on.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston. Josh is joining us. Hi, Josh.
Hi. You know, you've talked about the special effects and the narrative of Star Wars, but to me, the ultimate legacy of it is going to be the commercialization. I work for a group called the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood. We did a survey of all the junk food associated with the new film.
You got a list there?
There's 25 junk food products associated with the film, including such gems as Lava Berry Explosion Pop-Tarts, Star Wars Sweetened Oat Cereal with Marshmallows, Darth Dew Slurpees. Everything is, you know, high sugar, high fat, high calorie. You know, you talked about the campfire, but what one of the main things this film is doing is it's exploiting people's desire to be at the campfire just to sell them products, almost all of which are junk.
Who do you blame for that, Lucas or the studios or the tie-in marketers or all of the above?
All of the above, and a situation where, in order for films to be blockbusters now, this is the climate that's been created, and that we're really overwhelming parents so that it becomes increasingly hard for parents to say no to all mm-hmm. this junk food.
I think that's an excellent point. I think it's a really interesting angle on all this. Is that the studios are pushing they're pushing the marketing to such a point where they need these partners. You know, they'll pony right. up. You know, 20th Century Fox will kick in, say, 50, 60 million. I actually don't know the budget on this current Star Wars, but it's in that vicinity.
Somewhere I heard, Dave, that they had made, you go back over the whole series and they've made $3 billion at the box office and $9 billion selling plastic masks and Slurpees.
Oh, I'm sure. It's just the figure on the merchandise dwarfs the rest of it. But it's amazing that they get these partners to kick in their budgets and their, so it just becomes this echo chamber.
Right. And in a lot of cases, they have to be in place before the project gets greenlit, not just the Star
right.
Wars movie. One of my favorite horrible words of the moment is toyetic. Do you know this word, Dave?
No.
It's what the tie-in people call. The studio will bring them a project that's in pre-production, and they'll sort of kick the tires to see how toyetic it is. In other words, how many they can spin.
We're doing
off
Shrek 2. Yes. Do you want to be a
part
of this?
That's a very toyetic project.
Well, Steven Spielberg is producing a film from Hasbro based on the Transformers
right.
toys.
Right.
And that's totally, backwards in terms of the way it was developed. Hasbro came to Spielberg and said, hey, we'd really like to make a movie out of these toys.
Here's the thing. Makes money.
So, Josh, what do you do?
It does.
Josh, what do you do as a parent? I mean, you can't say, no, we're not going to that film. It's just a marketing tool.
It is extremely difficult to do that as a parent, which is why we need to start thinking about changing the culture and start thinking about restrictions on some of this marketing
But what can you do though? I mean, if somebody's doing The Little Mermaid and selling plastic cups at Wendy's with pretty pictures on it, at what level do you come in and say, it's tobacco, you can't do that?
It is tobacco.
I know. It's just I'm saying it's a hard case to make, isn't it?
You teach your children. I've taught. When my kids and I go to see a movie, I'll point out the Krispy Kreme's product placement, mm-hmm. and I'll say that's an ad, and they're aware of that stuff now. I'm teaching them that it's something that they should just be aware of.
Huh. Interesting. Dave, did you want to say something on that?
Yeah, media literacy, I think, is sort of the phrase that has caught on with a certain segment of the population. I agree with Ty. I think that's actually the best way to cope with it.
1-800-423-8255, talking about Star Wars, the story, the cultural symbols, all of that all rolled into one. Nashua, New Hampshire, and Susan's joining us. Hi, Susan.
Hello there. First of all, you really have to say no to children. You can't keep saying yes. And so stop blaming everybody else that's selling things. Just say no to them and grow up. And the other thing is, I'm in my late 60s and I still like to see fighting and carrying on in movies. And I've also watched Clerks. But I like the first Star Wars and I like The Empire Returns with Peter Cushing. It was really marvelous, I thought.
Is there anything in the stories themselves that draws you in? Is it just the flash and excitement about it? Is there something about the way the characters are presented, Susan? What would you say?
I think it's some of that. I do like the humor. I enjoy that. But as they're saying, there's not as much of that in the later ones. And that, I think, really makes the movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I love when I first saw Star Wars and the enormous, when you're sitting there and the spaceship comes over.
Yeah.
Good heavens, I was sort of, oh, good gracious me. And then a larger one came over after that.
I remember that, too.
I was just in awe of that. I thought, oh, my word, this is the best one I've ever seen.
Do you know the mistake that I've made, though, Susan, is since feeling exactly that same sense of awe, with the first one, I've sort of become lazy and waited for, whatever episode 4 or 5, I can't keep track of them, to come out on television. And I watch them with half an eye on television because none of that works on a little screen,
No, you need a big screen. That's why I'm going with my son. We're the only two out of the whole family that said we'll go and see it because I want to see this last one.
Are you going to sit in the front row?
No. I'm going to sit in the back. I always get a really good kick out of any movie I see in the back. I've always done it that way.
Have you ever seen Spaceballs?
The
Mel Brooks parody?
Yes, I have.
That
yes,
opens with the shot of the starship that goes on for about 3 minutes and just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going.
Oh, but he's brilliant.
Yes, he is.
Mel Brooks. I mean, it's it's so funny. But it's really good. I've really enjoyed the movies, and I see all the movies, including Clerks and all those movies. That, I thought, was very good, Clerks. Really thought that was so funny. I laughed and laughed at that one. But because it was so just like life, which is what we need.
Susan, I thank you for your call. 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join us to Rock Hill, South Carolina. And Elon is with us. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did it right.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that I agree with Susan 100%. There was a certain humor that was missing in these newer movies. I have to say I liked them, but I wasn't taken by them the way I was taken by episodes 4, 5, and 6. It lacked the swashbuckling. It lacked these amazing characters that were very endearing and charismatic. Yoda was there, but Yoda's been around since Empire Strikes Back.
I've got one for you, Elon. Just have a little listen here.
Solo! You knocked my Naya, Solo! Solo!
Right here, Jabba. I've been waiting for you.
Gone like we be.
You didn't think I was going to run, did you?
On my bookie. Kili Kali Akuga. Wanta Tabulira. Wonky Chisa Crispa Grido.
Look, Jabba, next time you want to talk to me, come see me yourself. Don't send one of these twerps.
You missed that, Elon.
What was that, Jabba?
Jabba and Han Solo, yeah.
Exactly, that's it. Jabba the Hutt. He was bigger than life, yet there was something very real about him. We all knew a Jabba the Hutt somewhere that we had encountered, whether he was our boss or a teacher in high school. Like, it was somebody that we could relate to that was actually, at the same time, larger than life and amazing.
What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I would totally agree with the caller. And the interesting thing, too, about this newest installment is that one of the big villains, the kind of Jabba of this piece, if you will, is a robot. You know, it's a completely digital creation.
This is General Grievous we're talking about?
Yes, yes. And it's just, it's not the same. It's just not the same as what was created before, in my view.
See, I found him kind of charming, but I totally agree that he's lacking that sort of rubbery of creature effects character, that personality that Jabba had. I also think, you know, one of the differences between the two trilogies you can point out as being the difference between Billy Dee Williams and Jimmy Smits. You know, the Billy Dee Williams character, Lando Calrissian, is like Han Solo. He's sort of a gambler, a playboy. He's light. He's airy. He's an Errol Flynn of the air. And, you know, Jimmy Smits is there just almost as window dressing, just to sort of take Leia at the end of episode 3. There is a lightness missing from these three films.
You know, and something, another point that was made, Dade, it comes from the sci-fi fans who are looking back at the 30 years of Star Wars and saying, you know, we have both gained something and lost something. Gained because we're mainstream, but lost because, you know, they're selling soft drinks in the cups of the characters, and that kind of edgy bit of sci-fi has been all sandpapered down to something that you know, a 3-year-old can chew on.
It's a really interesting point. It's sort of like the lament of comic book fans, true comic fans, who complain about this sort of Spider-Man effect and the fact that, you know, every Marvel property now is, you know, starring somebody and is coming to a big screen near you. And that is true of sci-fi. I think if you really, you know, think about Lucas's career, which, you know, goes back to THX-1138, which is a film he made while at USC, and it was really owed a big debt to Kubrick and was really a sort of out there, you know, sci-fi experiment. I just don't think anything about the current Star Wars and sort of the marketplace that it's occupying, it, you know, really kind of honors that sort of older, you know, sci-fi tradition. I mean, I think movies, even AI or Minority Report, that, you know, kind of have these bloodlines and these sort of the lineage of great sci-fi, they somehow don't come out, you know, feeling the same.
Well, great sci-fi provokes, asks a question, asks you to consider what if. Star Wars doesn't do that. I've never really considered it sci-fi. I've always sort of thought of it as an action or Western, a really good one, in outer space. Mm-hmm. But it's not it doesn't fulfill certain elements of the sci-fi genre. Maybe I'm getting label happy here, but it doesn't provoke.
Let's go to Boston. David's on the line. David, what do you think?
I'm calling because I saw Return of the Jedi when I was about 9 years old, and I grew up, I was born in 74, and I think if you weren't born between 70 and 80, you really don't grasp exactly what the Star Wars thing is really all about, because it permeated every aspect of my life. And specifically, being a child of a divorce, my parents divorced when I was six, and I can really identify with the relationship that Luke has with Vader, and that the kind of love but hate, wanting to bring him back. And I think that that's something that really tapped into kids, especially boys, maybe of my age.
Did you draw that connection when you were 9 years old and saw?
No. But it's something that even now, watching it when I'm 30, I still get choked up at that scene in Return of the Jedi at the end, when Vader's looking back and forth between Luke and the Emperor and deciding where his loyalty lies. And it almost makes me really emotional at that point. And I think that for a lot of kids, because, the divorce rate kind of surged in the 70s, that maybe a lot of kids may have that similar feeling towards when watching the movie. They can identify with those kind of feelings.
It's a really interesting point that you raise, and it sort of takes us back to where we began with the question, how much did Star Wars really insinuate itself into the way that we live our lives, into the cultural language of and I guess one way of measuring that data is to say, how much did it change Hollywood? How much are the movies that we see today a result of the response to Star Wars? Partly blockbusters, but partly just the way that stories are told.
I think there's a huge debt that a lot of current filmmakers owe to Lucas, for better or for worse. And filmmakers across the spectrum, whether they're making, $10 million indie films or, $200 million, mega budget tentpole movies. I think they all, strive for that sort of magical moment of transcendence and the kind of amazing mix of the swashbuckling, the technical wizardry as far as the special effects, and these heartfelt moments, as were just mentioned. I mean, the original films did have a heart, and they did sort of summon up, some emotion. I always thought it was brutally unfair that Pauline Kael, who I always admired as a critic, called the original an epic without a dream. And I said, what movie were you watching? I mean, I have to say, there was a dream. There was that, scene, and it's interesting that it comes full circle at the end of the
Ty, is it a formula that still works, though, in your mind?
Yeah, the formula of the first film?
The Star Wars formula in itself, what
Dave was
talking
about.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the coin of modern Hollywood. I think, the legacy of Star Wars and what Lucas did is that he's created his enfranchised fantasy as, in many ways, the only way to go. It's all about creating an alternate reality in the most realistic way, a way to completely plug yourself into at a time when most movies were very, very realistic. And what we have now, especially in most blockbuster movies, are created worlds completely separate from any questions that we have to deal with in our real life. And sometimes I think it goes too far. Often I think it goes too far.
I thank you so much for coming in to be with
us
today.
Sure, thank you.
Ty Burr is film critic for the Boston Globe. Here I am rushing to get through my own credits. Should just scroll them slowly across the screen. Dade Hayes, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Dade is senior editor for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.